Have a good, safe trip, Michael, Mom whispered, pressing her cheek against mine. Dad hugged me too. I'll be fine, I told them. I'll call you from Aunt Sandra's. Mom handed me a white envelope. Dad picked up my duffel bag and walked me to the gate. You're in seat 1A, he told me. He gave me the duffel bag and patted me on the shoulder. I turned and waved to them. Mom was wiping tears off her cheeks with both hands. Wow, I thought, why are they so worried? Am I the first kid in history to fly to Orlando by himself? I didn't see any flight attendants as I stepped into the plane, but my seat was easy to find. It was the very first seat in the front row of the first class section. I settled back against the soft leather seat and remembered the envelope my mom had just given me. I had jammed it into my jeans pocket. I pulled it out and studied it, a plain white envelope. Was it a letter? Did Mom and Dad write me a note or something? I tore the envelope open and pulled out a sheet of paper, brought it close to my face, and my heart skipped a beat as I gazed in shock at the short message. We are not your parents. Hello.
And welcome
to Say Podcast and Die,
the podcast where two queers sit in their closet and talk to you about Goosebumps.
I'm Alyssa.
I'm Andy.
And this week we're talking to you about Goosebumps Series 2000, number 16, The Mummy Walks.
And this week we are yet again joined by a small, few weeks old intern who may be occasionally grunting and making herself known.
She didn't even bring us coffee.
She didn't, no. We have to bring her drinks, apparently. And
I'm not saying that she got the job through nepotism, but her resume was kind of thin.
We also, our sound quality has been kind of something we take pretty seriously, but we're still in between recording setups right now, so bear with us as we continue to try to find the best setup.
All right, what's going on with our cover this week, Andy?
Well, this reminds me of a Renaissance artist you could probably tell me the name of. Is it Michelangelo, where he paints everyone with giant feet?
You mean how the statues are?
Oh, is that what I'm talking? Yeah, I think proportionally, so. The feet are always super big
because you're supposed to see them from far, far down, and so it would sort of.
Well, I guess that applies here actually, because we're looking at the mummy Pukra from below. So he's got great big giant feet and hands, and he's coming out of a cave rock wall. This is a scene that is not actually in the book.
No, it is not.
It's what some characters in the book think they're going to see. It's a pretty simple one, kind of. You know what it reminds me most of is Terror Tower.
Oh, yeah.
The big hulking executioner in a stone walkway.
Well, the thing that stood out most to me was that the embalmers took the time to wrap each individual toe in linen.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a non-traditional mummy.
Yeah, exactly. Which we'll get into.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Man, because this is not an Egyptian mummy.
No, no.
It is a Jezekian mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to give everyone the bird's eye view of this plot?
We had wondered last week if we'd be returning to Gabe and his story, and we are not.
Mm-mm.
We follow Michael, who is supposed to be flying to Orlando for his first time to see his aunt. His mom and dad very emotionally put him on a plane, and then when he gets on the plane, he's the only person on it, and they have given him a note that says, "We are not your parents."
Such a great moment. Mm-hmm. One of the high points in all of the Gooseverse, I would say.
Yeah. The people flying him call him His Excellency, and soon he learns that he is the heir to the kingdom of Jezekiah, which is in an unnamed place but is desert. So
it's somewhere in the Middle East.
It seems like
it's
in
North
Africa. Yeah, or North Africa, exactly.
I have theories. I'm worried about giving them because it seems like a hot button issue.
I mean, Arl Stein picked this, not us.
Yeah.
There he meets this general who says, "You had a chip implanted in your brain that told you where this mummy is."
I like that random turn to sci-fi. Unexpected.
There's also this sapphire that the mummy has, and this war has been fought over it for 12 years.
They just threw in everything.
Fucking everything. So Michael has no idea where the fuck this mummy is. He meets a girl, Megan, who says that she is the general's adopted daughter and she's going to help him. They go out into the desert looking for the mummy because Michael made up where he thought it was. They get captured by rebels and then they get sent home to New York. And it turns out Mom and Dad, the Clarks, or not his real mom and dad, had the mummy the whole time and they had his microchip removed. And that's kind of it. Then Megan absconds with the mummy because she was a double agent working for her father the whole time.
Yeah, a lot of kids in positions of political authority in these books, mm-hmm. right? It reminded me of the reality police and how it's staffed by children.
Yeah.
So I guess there's different labor laws in the Gooseverse.
I mean, I think monarchy, you can set your own laws, right?
Especially the monarchy of a nation that's not been recognized by any other countries as a nation.
Yeah.
Which it seems to be the case with Jezekiah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, I have so much to say about this book. it goes in some very unexpected directions for a Goosebumps book. I think this is the most international political conflict we've gotten, as opposed to intergalactic.
Oh, yeah. Like, we're talking about war between humans, humans who have rifles and...
And jeeps.
Yeah, and jeeps and dress in camo and shoot at each other.
Yeah, I was really interested in this. So let's jump in. I also just wanted to flag at the top here, it is Easter weekend that we're putting this out, which seems appropriate for the undead rising in a cave in the Middle East.
There you go.
Stalking out.
Topical. We open with a chaotic airport scene. Mom and Dad are seeing their son, Michael, off.
Pre-2001, so they're just all running through the airport.
Yeah, they can just waltz through security. He's very excited to be going to Orlando, and he doesn't understand why his parents are so emotional about
it. Yeah, they're over the top. Everyone in this airport is over the top. They're all crying and fighting with each other and things, but his parents are acting like this is really, really terrifying, and it makes sense later why they feel that way.
They give him a note, they put him on the plane, he's in first class. There's no one else on the plane, and he opens the note, and it says, "We are not your parents." And then he tries to get off the plane, but the doors have closed. A voice tells him to sit down, and eventually a man named Lieutenant Henry comes out of the cockpit to talk to him.
He's
got
to
make him lunch.
Yeah, well, make him lunch, hand him a sandwich and a Coke. He says he's going to make him lunch, but that's what he does. Lieutenant Henry sounds kind of cute. He's got a ponytail and a mustache.
And diamond stud and a camo jacket.
Yeah, he's got a little gray streak in his hair.
Yeah, and he calls Michael Excellency, but won't explain why he's doing that.
I mean, there's a lot happening in this book, but it definitely has shades of P.S. Don't Write Back, which kind of started to tread this territory of your parents suddenly rejecting you.
Yeah.
Leaving you adrift.
Michael thinks, oh, maybe the plane was hijacked. Like, that must be what's happening.
Arl Stein was around in the 70s.
Yeah.
That's what I say to that. I mean, I would just say that's the first moment in what's going to be a bunch of really awkward kind of gestures towards the history of Middle East conflict in the 70s through the 90s that Arl Stein is just kind of splashing around with, throwing at a canvas, but not actually, I mean, unless he's really thinking about it, he's not thinking about it.
He's not thinking about it. But yeah, I mean, hijackings regarding Middle East politics would have been in the news as he was coming up, but... This is another one where, oh, post 9/11, you couldn't have written a children's book suggesting a plane was being hijacked. The reason we're referencing the 70s is planes used to be hijacked fairly frequently, and it was kind of just very cash. Probably they would just take you to Cuba, and, you know, you'd be inconvenienced on wherever, whatever route that you were flying.
Getting back to it, this is a food book. So go to sleep, wake up, cornflakes and orange juice, looking out at the desert, white rocks are poking up like bones. We're about to get another good food scene.
They land at the airport, and lots of people are waiting for him and cheering and waving pennants. And the army is waiting for him.
This is where I really started to be like, where is this going? Because it's green pennants, which made me think maybe like Libya or something was being referenced. People are wearing either white robes or camouflage. And I'm like, oh, this is really just getting into like, here are my stereotypes of the Middle East. And I'm just throwing them down.
He's greeted by someone named General Ramir.
Who has a pinky ring and a cane and a linen suit.
And
I feel like he's like a southern, I don't know.
Southern gentleman.
Yeah, he's like Colonel Sanders randomly here.
He tells Michael to get into this car and they'll take him to the palace, but he doesn't want to get in until he can talk to his parents. And General Ramir says, your parents are dead.
There's such good chapter stingers in this one. Like the best ones.
Yeah. And so he's freaking out and he's like, oh, no, the Clarks aren't your parents. Your parents were killed in a war and the Clarks took you and hid you in America. And you're the ruler of Jezekiah, and you can prove that by telling us the location of the mummy. And Michael is just like, I have no idea what the fuck you were talking about.
There was a while here where I wondered if he was being punked a la Welcome to Camp Nightmare.
Yeah.
But no, there's been a 12-year struggle with rebel forces who, according to General Ramir, we don't know who to trust about this civil war that seems to be happening, but General Ramir says there's rebel forces who want to take control and destroy our nation. Jezekiah is your homeland, Michael. It is your nation. You're supposed to rule. So let's just take a pause here and flag why I want to talk about Israel later, because we have a boy from Long Island going to his homeland to, you know, claim his inheritance, and there's these rebel forces there. That's at least the take that General Ramir is presenting on the situation. So it seems if any specific part of the Middle East and North Africa is being referenced, it's Israel and Palestine.
It really seems that way, yeah. They bring him to the palace. It's very opulent. And they tell him about the mummies of Jezekiah. They say they mummified people too, just as the Egyptians did. And this emperor is one of the oldest known mummies in the world, or is the oldest known mummy in the world. And it used to live in the palace, but when the war broke out, it was not safe for it to be there. So Michael's real parents hid it along with the Jezekiah sapphire. The Jezekiah sapphire, it's very beautiful. And also their entire treasury is based on it.
Yeah, this is where I stopped and I said, okay, I don't know how national economies work, but that seems like a bad setup.
Yeah, it's like if we were still in the gold standard and then
we had one bar of gold.
And then you just hid it somewhere.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh, I guess we all have to find that bar of gold now.
Trust us, we have it, though.
Yeah, we definitely
Please,
do.
Like, trade with us as a country.
Yeah, I can totally purchase arms for this war based on the fact that we have that one bar of gold somewhere.
Yeah, and it's like, why isn't it enough to have a powerful mummy that if you control it, controls the world? It also has a jewel hidden in it.
And what are they going to do when they have it? Like, you can't trade it because it's your entire economy.
I don't know.
I think probably Arlstein understands as much about economics as we do. It's probably the thing.
I will say one of the points, one of the areas in which this country is truly wealthy is its spreads. so they have fruit, dates, figs, roast chicken, lamb, salads, potatoes, rice, and a flatbread spread with a, quote, thick brown paste that's kind of sweet and spicy. I wondered if it's that tahini pomegranate molasses thing that we had in Turkey. Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
I just was like, man.
Hungry.
Hook me up with this feast scene.
This is when he's told that his parents implanted a memory chip in his brain, and it'll also be called a microchip or in a computer chip at various points throughout the story.
Yeah, and General Ramir starts pressuring him, like, tell us where the mummy is. And he has a brilliant solution for getting out of the situation, which is to pass out.
Yeah. And so they send him to his room to recover.
And along the way, he sees oil paintings of people that look like him. So he wonders, are these really my ancestors? Am I really this person? Because his parents, maybe
tall, skinny, white people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And not super strategically, if they actually want to hide him, have been saying his whole life, you don't look anything like us. It's like we're hardly related, which is a Goosebumps theme.
Yeah.
You know, it's been around since the early books, but, you know, oh, these people in the family don't look like these people in the family. But here it actually has a point.
Yeah. He's dark, short, and chubby. And so there's almost this, like, suggestion of transracial and transnational adoption, which is kind of what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now he's wondering, are these people really my ancestors?
So he tries to call home, and an operator, it says, a man's voice purred in my ear.
Yeah, he purrs multiple times. It's very awkward.
He finds out he can't call out, and the door is locked.
But there's a girl hiding in his room. Her name is Megan Kerr. She is American.
She has a white polo shirt tucked into white shorts.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
a look.
She does.
She sounds like a lesbian, right? I mean, tucking in your polo shirt as a 12-year-old.
Yeah, working in, like, intelligence and double-crossing people, sure. Her parents were advisors to General Ramir, but they were killed in the war, and so he adopted her.
Yeah, they were killed in a bomb explosion. This is a different direction than Goosebumps books normally go in.
Yeah.
So, like, the original series, not at all. Series 2000 has gotten more violent, but this is a different kind.
The more, yeah, more real violence.
Right.
Megan says it's horrible here. It's just this opulent palace, and you can't get any good CDs.
And they won't let you hang posters on the walls.
Yeah.
You won't get your deposit back.
Megan tells him that he's in trouble because Ramir plans to kill him. He's not going to let Michael rule the kingdom ever. And if he doesn't know where the mummy is, they'll torture him. So that's cool.
Yeah.
And then she's caught by the guards, it seems, and is taken away. And Michael uses this opportunity to escape himself.
We have one of two really weird fly scenes here. There's one later. In this one, a horsefly is pounding itself against the window again and again. And he's like, ah, that gives me an idea.
Yeah, the window.
Yeah. So he's more successful than the horsefly at getting out of it.
Well, yeah.
Oh, no, he's not, actually.
No.
He gets caught.
Yeah, he gets caught and is brought to General Ramir, who is looking at maps of the country. And he points out the capital city of Ramen.
I thought it was
Ramen.
Oh, yeah. I thought it might be Ramallah, like in Palestine.
Either Arlstein is being very conscientious of that, or he was hungry.
Yeah, it's ramen with two N's.
Yeah.
There's a lot of weird stuff like that. Where,
yeah.
Like, there's a character later called Mohammed, but just Moham.
Yeah. This map has a bunch of caves on it, and he says, well, which cave is the mummy in? And if he can't remember, they're going to cut his head open to get the microchip out. So they send him back to his room.
It's a weird use of a microchip because, you know, our dogs have microchips and you just scan them and it gives you the information like you're scanning a barcode at a supermarket.
I mean, it was implanted in him in the late 80s, so maybe just microchip technology has come further.
They might not have, oh, well, we have it on this floppy disk. And you're like, well, thanks.
And the floppy disk is for some reason sewn up inside of you. So we have to cut you open to get the floppy disk.
I really think they could have put this information somewhere else.
Yeah, they really could have. Anywhere else. If it's on a microchip, there are many places it could have lived.
I mean, this is reminiscent of working with across different generations on a group project. And you're like, can we just use Google Drive? And they're like, no, we're going to send each other a Word document and just keep using track changes again and again and again.
Well, this reminded me of Face Off because there's a part where they tell the main dude is, oh, we put a microchip in your throat.
Isn't he like Castor or Pollux?
Yeah, Castor Troy and his brother is Pollux, I think. And we're going to put a microchip in your throat to give you the voice of Nicolas Cage. And the screenwriters said in like a commentary, you know, we just put that in as a placeholder. I'm like, we'll figure this out later. And it just never got taken out. But like, it doesn't make any sense. And that's all I could think about for this book. It's like, what is this microchip doing there?
Well, in the 90s, all we knew is microchips are high tech.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They can do many things.
They're micro.
Yeah.
There's no Megan when he gets back to his room. And then Lieutenant Henry comes for him and sort of intrigues him to cooperate. And when Michael says, I don't know anything, he orders Michael taken to surgery.
And then he's like, wait, I do know. I'll tell you later. And they're like, okay, well, that's good enough for us.
Yeah.
And then he goes and points to a random cave on the map and says, it's that one. And it's behind a rock wall. He's like, good way to sell it by coming up with a detail.
Yeah.
They believe him and send him off. And he has a fitful night of not being able to sleep.
And that night, Megan sneaks into his room.
Black tank top, black skirt, black tights.
And Michael's like, oh my god, you're okay. And she's like, yeah, nothing was done to me. I'm the general's adopted daughter.
Right.
And she then tells him about the curse on the mummy. That if he falls into evil hands, he'll walk.
Yeah, and we can't have that.
Yeah, gotta stay in one place.
I think, yeah, the idea is the mummy will walk the earth until evil is destroyed. And that seems like a good thing.
It does.
Why not go wake that mummy up?
Yeah, seriously.
Put it in the wrong hands.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm having trouble following the concerns
here. Yeah. And she says, did you really remember? And he's like, oh yeah, I really did.
But she knows better, luckily.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to add, you know how we have like food watch, fashion watch, mm-hmm. bird watch, red ball of a sun watch.
yeah, that's been with us a long time.
Yeah. Across Fear Street, across the Goose Verse, the sun is a red ball. And here it is again. Over a bunch of jeeps outside of the palace.
It turns out Jezekiah is small enough that you can get anywhere in the country in about a day. He sees strange but beautiful scenery, but he can't enjoy it because he knows he can't escape, essentially.
Yeah, there's some scrawny black and white birds, and he wonders if they're desert vultures. Maybe there are black vultures,
mm-hmm.
in addition to the more familiar turkey vulture, birdwatch.
Well, they get to the cave, and he starts to confess that he lied, and General Ramirez looks really angry, and then rebels attack, which is why, so maybe Megan didn't know he was lying. He just, like, fucking told everyone.
Yeah, and he thinks, oh, General Ramirez was actually just mad because he saw the rebels, but maybe he just knows. Everyone's very good at manipulating Michael in this.
Yeah, he tries to run away, but the fighting is basically over, and so Ramirez catches him.
It seems like there's, the 12 years of war is not over.
No.
Like, they said, oh, it's over, we won, but it seems like that's not really the case.
No, my understanding was that they brought Michael back in order to end it, basically.
Oh, yeah, and also the status of Jezekiah as a country, I'm really confused about that. There's a point where General Ramirez asks Michael if he studied Jezekiah in school, and he says no, and General Ramirez is like, oh, we're really working to put it on the map.
So it's like, I'm from America, we don't study most countries.
That's true, that's a good point. But it seems like it's this little parcel of land that there's two factions fighting over, but the rest of the world doesn't even really recognize it as a meaningful parcel of land.
Yeah.
Or like as having a
sovereign,
its own borders.
Yeah. Megan is safe, and Ramirez gets mad at her because she hid under a jeep, and he's like, don't you know that could explode if it gets shot?
If I had read this as a kid, I would have been like, man, I'm glad books are telling me useful things.
Yeah, same.
Put that in my pocket. Remember not to hide under a jeep if you're in a shooting war.
Well, they don't go into the cave because they have to purify themselves with sand.
Right. So that is a very strange moment, right? This like little detour the book takes where they go on this long purification ritual where they bury themselves in the sand, they take off their shoes. It felt very like Book of Exodus to me, you know, burning bush, got to take off your shoes. And also very, are you familiar with the Holy of Holies?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the middle of the temple where the priest can only go in once a year and it's here the version of it is, if we view the mummy in an unclean state, it'll take its revenge on us. And I feel like this is kind of a fan fiction-y version of the Holy of Holies, where you have to go and purify it or else, you know, you'll be smitten.
And then after finishing the book, the ending sort of casts this like shadow over everything else. And so now I'm like, were they doing this just because some guys knew they had to go in there and build a rock wall?
To make Michael think that he'd tricked them?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Because that's kind of why they bring Meg in.
They must think it's so funny watching them bury themselves up to the neck in sand and just sit there chanting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what they do. But I love the idea that they're just like, let's see what we can make this guy do next.
We just have to find a reason to not go in the cave yet.
Then they go into the cave and the stone wall is there, possibly just having been planted by General Ramirez's men.
Well, it must be because Megan is behind it. Okay,
yeah. So when else would she have gotten there?
Yeah, so they start taking it down and the mummy is there and it, you know, everyone runs away, but it grabs Michael, but it's Megan.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think you're right. Because also, if the mummy was walking, I don't think they would all run away. I think they'd be like, great, we found the mummy. Let's catch it.
Yeah.
It's an old mummy. We can probably out-strong-arm it.
And none of them are stopping to reflect on the implication that that would mean that they were evil.
I mean, I think they don't really care about that part. Yeah. But it does kind of defeat the purpose if the idea is you have the mummy so you can control the world. But if the mummy's out to destroy you, that probably means you can't use it to control the world.
Yeah, it's not really a good system of governance.
Well, and I just think the mummy seems like it's very well designed. It has some built-in safeguards where you can only use it to control the world if you're not evil.
I wonder if it's like, we've been at war for 12 years, like, fuck it, let's try the mummy thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like, was it Star Wars where Reagan wanted to put like a force field around the country?
Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that.
Yeah.
It's like, why not a force field?
Yeah. Megan and Michael start to head out of the cave, and then rebels show up.
Mm-hmm. And Megan's like, they're even more evil than the general and his men.
And more desperate.
And this is where we meet General Mahum. Who has curly black hair and wears black trousers, and he has an unbuttoned black shirt showing off his chest. It's a look.
Well, Michael tries to run away again, but they get him, and
a lot of this book is taken up with Michael trying to get away and then not getting very far.
The other thing is, they say, okay, we need to look at that chip, and he's like, no, don't cut me open. And they look at him like he's an idiot. They're like, we have an x-ray machine, we don't need to cut you open.
And there's a weird moment where they're like, yeah, we stole this from a hospital across the border. We should have stolen a CAT scan machine.
But we don't have enough power out here.
I guess they just needed to fill up some space on this page.
Did you need to feel like you needed to justify whether there's an x-ray machine in the desert?
Yeah, because it doesn't really make sense also to x-ray a microchip, I'm pretty sure.
Just to check that it's there, but also, yeah, I don't actually know if the x-ray would penetrate your skull. It probably wouldn't.
I don't know.
Unless the microchip is just like on the outside of his skull. I don't know.
But it wouldn't help them read it.
I think they're just checking to see if it's there.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Well, they don't find it and they're like, he's not the right boy.
Yeah.
And then they debate, you know, whether to kill him or not. And someone's like, oh, we don't want trouble with the U.S. He's an American citizen.
Right. It's Raul. I'm like, why is Raul here?
Yeah. What if he's just like a soldier of fortune, right?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm join this war.
What's that word called where someone's like
mercenary?
A soldier? Yeah, he's a mercenary. He's like, a Hessian.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is where we got our second fly moment. There's a fly that just keeps landing on his face. It's like this moment we spend a lot of time on.
Well, then they suggest throwing Michael into the python pit.
And yes, not a ferret pit this time.
So I have a theory about this for later, but like, so they're rebels. They travel around, like they're guerrillas. They don't have like a fixed like army base. So either they're traveling around with like a kiddie pool full of pythons and that's the python pit, or they're like digging a hole and then tossing all their pythons in. But either way, they're traveling around with a bunch of pythons, right? Because otherwise there wouldn't just be a python pit. You have to make sure there is one.
Maybe they work for Emery Banyan Studios and it's the same people. Oh, I should have saved this for Shared Universe, but it's the same people who are like the snake wranglers for his scene in the desert. Now that's like their side gig. That's how they fund their rebellion, is their python wranglers.
We'll come back to this. We'll come back to this.
Oh, yeah. Great. Cool.
Actually, I like that though. It's like very like CIA, like we're gonna sell LSD and fund shit. I don't know.
Yeah, we're gonna make some media, fund some Jackson Pollocks, and then also oversee torture.
Yeah, you know. They're about to throw him into the python pit, and Megan has an idea, and then we just cut to them landing at JFK.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone didn't feel like filling in the gaps. We had another book like that recently, too, right? Oh, you know what it was? It was Brain Juice.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, we're gonna kill them, and then
they're home.
Yeah, and this book actually did remind me a lot of the beats of Brain Juice.
Less molesty, though, which is nice. It's a nice change of pace in Series 2000. Well, Megan Michael thanks her for her quick thinking, you know, oh, I'm glad they didn't throw me in the python pit. She's like, they were never going to do it. They just wanted to threaten you. And then basically we learn that what she said was, so you should send Michael back and send me too. And then my father will be so distraught that he'll stop fighting the war and look for me.
It's because he's the only one fighting, apparently.
Yeah, he's the only one who cares.
Yeah, my guess is once they figured out the microchip and it was in his head, they're just like, we have no use for you. So go ahead, leave.
Do you think they purchased his plane ticket?
That's a good question. Someone had to. He didn't have a plane ticket to get there, so he's going to have real passport problems.
Yeah.
Because he probably didn't even bring a passport. He thought he was flying to Orlando by way of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Out of JFK.
Yeah. Well, Megan reminds him that she has nowhere to go, essentially, because her parents are dead and she doesn't have any friends or family in the States. So Michael calls the Clarks, aka mom and dad. They pick him up and they pick up Megan too. I'm amazed that he still trusts them after what they just pulled.
They must work for Ramir on behalf of the Kingdom of Jezekiah. So I don't know that they're the most trustworthy place to hide out.
Yeah, they're somehow involved in the high level politics of another nation.
Yeah, and they've been getting paid for it.
Yeah.
By like this militia run kingdom.
Well, they tell him when they get home, they tell Michael, because Michael's like, can you believe they thought this? And they say, oh no, you are actually the Prince of Jezekiah. You had a memory chip, but we had it removed.
It's a good call, honestly.
Yeah. And so we thought that when they asked for you to be sent back, they discover you didn't have it and then ship you right back. That's quite a gamble with his life.
Yeah. It reminded me I was thinking they're about as good of parents as the parents in Return to Horrorland.
Yeah.
Because how much was it per kid? It was like $2,000 they got paid or something.
Something like that. Yeah. Not enough.
So they go show him the mummy. It's behind the wardrobe in the basement. There's a hidden door back there.
A basement in Long Island is maybe not the ideal condition for an ancient mummy.
Unless it's like waterproofed or something.
And like they have like extreme like humidity control.
And it's in a wooden case, which I was surprised by. Mm-hmm.
Mummy case again.
Yes, not a sarcophagus. And yeah, not stone.
Well, I mean, this is a Jezekiah mummy. We don't know actually what their practices are, but yeah.
And then they open it and you're like, wait, you're going to destroy the mummy, kids.
Who cares?
I guess it's a magic mummy. Maybe it's indestructible.
Everyone goes to bed. Megan stays over. But in the morning, Michael goes to find her and she's gone. And she's left him a note saying that she has been working with General Ramir the entire time. He's her adopted father. They love each other. She was in on it all along. You know, she was never sneaking into his room. So she's gone. Michael goes to find mom and dad and they check the mummy and it's gone. And there's a note in Megan's handwriting that says, "The mummy walks."
Which implies that it's been set off on a path to destroy evil, right? Because isn't that what makes the mummy walk?
I don't think it's actually walking. I think she took it.
And she's just like making a joke or something.
Something like that, yeah.
That sounded cool. Didn't really think through.
Yeah.
Much like the author of this book.
So that was my read of it. Like, yeah. I see no evidence that anything supernatural happens.
I think you're right. I also am just wondering, do mom and dad also already know, right? Like, why would they take in the daughter of General Ramir and just be like, well, here's the mummy. We're going to sleep.
Right? Yeah.
Like, they must... Everyone is in on this except Michael, is my impression. And it was really random to send him there in the first place, actually. Like, there must be some other reason that he went there, because the microchip wasn't there, and it seems like the Clarks have continued to have a good working relationship with General Ramir and his daughter, so...
Well, or they fear him to some degree and felt like they couldn't say no, or just say, like, look, we took out the microchip, like, we're holding on to the mummy for you. They clearly don't trust him... Totally.
Well, yeah, maybe they were happy to let her take the mummy because they're like, now it's not our problem.
I don't know what their investment in Jezekiah is.
Is Megan just going to put the mummy on the plane next to her, like buy him a seat? How's this going to work?
She's probably got another fancy first class seat. They'll probably both get served sandwiches.
Ice cream sundaes, apparently, in this book. You get in first class.
Nice. All right. Well, before we move into taxonomies, I just want to say I turned the page after this was done and saw the author's note. And the first sentence is, R.L. Stine is the most popular author in America. How far we've come since Welcome to Dead House.
I know. I'm very proud of him.
Mm-hmm.
It's been saying that for a few books now, I've noticed, and what a moment.
Yeah.
What a moment in our history.
Mm-hmm.
If you were just checking in on the U.S. in 1999, you're like, so what do people like to read here?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about taxonomies?
Let's do it.
Speaking of liking to read.
Well, my first one is called Everyone's In On It.
Yeah, everyone, not everyone. Michael.
Yeah, everyone but Michael.
I wonder even if there is actually an active rebellion or if Moham and Ramir and Raul are all just buddies and that on the
was
same
what
team.
That's exactly what I was going to posit in theories.
All political theater.
Yeah, it must be, right? Because otherwise, what's the fucking Python Pit doing there? Like, why didn't anyone get killed? Why did it not last long enough? Like,
a couple people got wounded, supposedly.
Supposedly.
But, you know, that could also be smoke and mirrors.
Is the war even still ongoing? You know? Maybe not.
Is this a show on the Monster Channel?
Right? That is actually my working theory, is that those rebels weren't actually rebels.
Yeah, I think that actually, the more we talk about it, the more I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. I feel really bad for Michael, though. Like, this is a real who do I trust ever again situation.
But, like, the fact that they just be like, oh, sure, we'll put you on a plane because this random chick suggested it. Like, no.
It's so much like brain juice now that we talk about it.
Yeah.
Except Michael doesn't realize that he's not very bright. So tell me more about your taxonomy category.
Oh, yeah. So The Game, which I think we touched on last week, David Fincher movie. There's a short story by Shirley Jackson called Paranoia about this guy following this other guy, it seems, maybe. And he gets home and his wife is like, oh, what a terrible day you had. And then he hears her on the phone being like, yeah, he's here.
Uh-huh.
And then there is one of the things I thought of the most was the episode of Black Mirror called White Bear, which is from season 2, where this woman wakes up and everyone's following her and filming her, and it turns out it's all for their entertainment.
You know what else is like this?
Hmm.
The show Old Enough, which we have been watching like nonstop every time I have to pump for feeding the baby. We watch a little bit of Old Enough, which is a Japanese TV show, if you haven't heard of it, where a 2 to 4 year old gets sent on an errand by themselves.
Yeah.
And basically the whole town knows that this is happening and is filming them while they try to figure out how to go pick up like a certain brand of mustard from the store down the street.
Yeah, they're just like not super observant. Although some people will see the camera, some kids will see the camera. They're like, huh.
Do you think this whole thing was old enough? But for Michael, as a 12-year-old, like, so can Michael, 12 years old, you know, go and successfully, like, fool these rebels in this foreign country?
Will he believe that he has a microchip implanted in his brain?
Right.
And convince them that he doesn't?
And they've just put a mic on him and he doesn't know it.
Yeah.
Yeah, great category. I love it.
How about you?
My first one was hidden treasure, parentheses, person. So, well, this isn't quite a person, but the mummy made me think of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which has this subplot where there's a golem in the town that's like a source of the town's power, and they have to try to get it out when there's invaders coming. The Da Vinci Code, spoiler, the Virgin Mary's descendant. No, not the Virgin Mary's. Well, I guess Jesus is her descendant, but Jesus and Mary Magdalene's descendant is the treasure. Then How I Got My Shrunken Head, of course, the other like literary giant
along with Dan Brown and
Cavalier and Clay.
Yeah, Michael Chabon. Yeah.
Yeah. Three literary giants. So How I Got My Shrunken Head, it was kind of a similar story to that, right? But there he had a magic word planted in his brain.
Yeah, it's interesting. Something that this kind of reminds me of as you're talking is something I noticed when I was putting my taxonomies together, which is a lot of these aren't specifically horror tropes. Like, they come more from adventure literature.
Same.
Yeah.
Which R.L. Stine wrote, I mean, you know, I'm
and
sure.
And read and all that, yeah.
Indiana Jones prepared him to write this.
That's on my list here, yeah.
And I think just the idea of a hidden treasure being a human, dead or alive, like in Shrunken Head or Audrey Tautou and...
Oh my gosh, it wasn't gold?
Right. But it's also... I don't know, like, what do you make of that? This idea that this relic of a body would be where the source of power is.
Well, I think on some level it's supposed to make you think, like, oh, I underestimated the value of a human, right?
Yeah.
But also, if you think about something like the Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, I mean, he also does just have human remains that he's, like, carrying around, so it's both valuable and cheap on some level.
Right, and it's also, like, not so much I underestimated the values of a person, is that I didn't realize I could put monetary value on a person.
Yeah, why didn't I think of that? Yeah, you're totally right.
What's your next one?
Secret Royalty.
Ah. I've got a similar one.
Yeah, Princess Diaries, Star Wars.
I had Princess Diaries.
Yeah.
It's so much like that. You're a princess of Genovia.
I mean, Harry Potter too, kind of. Like, he's not like literally royalty, but kind of.
I called my category, you're a wizard, Harry.
What else did you have?
I had, so like you, I had Princess Diaries, and then I also had The Phantom Menace, you know? your blood carries midichlorians, and you're the chosen one who will bring balance. It's a real eugenicist streak to some of these stories, also in the Da Vinci Code, which makes sense if you're trying to make an inheritance argument. Mm-hmm. Spy Kids was another one I thought of.
Oh, yeah.
What's so special about being a Cortez, the boy of the family asks. And it's like, well, for one thing, your dad's Antonio Banderas. So
that's pretty fucking special.
And your mom is Carla Gugino.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty great.
Yeah. So that's what the problem is. But also, it turns out you also somehow know spy stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, but the biggest one, actually, this guy reminds me of, Michael, is Morty from Rick and Morty. Because it's not that he's actually special. He's useful.
Yeah.
His brain was useful to someone else who needed to hide something.
And he was just, like, proximate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you think of any horror examples in the genre? Because I really couldn't. But there must be. But at the same time, I feel
The Omen.
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah. Secret royalty.
The Devil's Heir.
Oh, and Rosemary's Baby, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And The Devil's Advocate, also.
True. True, true, true. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I would say ones like that. So usually Satan.
Yeah. But it's inverted, right? It's like, oh, no, you're heir to something you didn't want to be heir to.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of in this also. But I don't know. It reads more on the sort of adventure side of things.
The closest it gets to horror is when Megan stalks out pretending to be the mummy. But for the most part, this stays in the category of political drama meets adventure. And I guess there's the psychological horror part where the family he thinks has been his family this whole time suddenly cuts him off.
No, but of course we sort of gloss over that.
Yeah. Okay, so that actually bleeds into my next category, if you don't mind, which is like biblically loaded Middle East political conflict, which shows up in a lot of horror, right? The Exorcist, The Omen. So those are stories where someone gets an inheritance they didn't want, necessarily.
Is that why you're watching Jesus Christ Superstar today?
That is exactly what else was on here. Jesus Christ Superstar. So he's like, I didn't want it. You know, I didn't ask for this and you're putting it on me. And it is, you know, there's a way you could look at the JC Superstar story and read it as horror.
And, I mean, The Last Temptation of Christ explicitly goes in that direction. It's the gospel story until about the last half hour where the last temptation is to get off the cross and have a normal life.
And kids who grew up horror fans who also had to go to church, I mean, I think a lot of us loved the Good Friday service for how, like fucking insane it got.
Metal.
Yeah, it got super metal, right? It's the one where they try to scare you. Turn off all the lights and there's, like, a sound of nails going into wood.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. At least at my church.
I don't think I ever went to a Good Friday service.
I don't see why you would. But, like, that's the, at least, and that was at, like, a pretty milquetoast Lutheran church where that happened. So I think it gets even more intense if you're Catholic or Orthodox or something.
Yeah. Damn.
I know. But yeah, I guess my point is...
I was going to say, did you ever share your Easter egg hunt on this podcast?
I don't know. But yeah, that's a good example of the horror, too.
One sec.
So, yeah, my parents went to a milquetoast Lutheran church, very middle-of-the-road Protestant, but I went to a fundamentalist Christian school, as I think I've shared on this podcast before, and they were much more, as you say, metal. We had...
Not in a good way, though.
No, we had felt bored of the Pilgrim's Progress story, where you have people, like, being beaten and, you know, drowning in a slew of despond, and it was a felt bored story for children. But anyway, my first grade teacher, Cheryl Howard, shout out to Cheryl, she had us do this Easter egg hunt. We were 6 years old, right? And we go around the classroom and we all find these little plastic eggs, and then we're opening them in front of the class. We're not supposed to open them, so we each have one, and we open them, and the first kid opens it, and it's salt water. And she's like, yuck, that's the tears that Christ shed because of you and your sin. And then we open another egg, and she's like, thorns smashed into his head, so he bled for you because of your sin. And we're like, oh my god. And she's like, they were much bigger. There was, like, nails in one. Anyway, we get to the final egg, and it's, like, bigger, and it's gold, and the kid who has it is, like, clearly excited, like, okay, well, we got through all that stuff, but this will be the good one.
I just love the idea of my first grader opening up an egg. Like, what is it? It's full of nails.
Yeah, railroad spikes. No, it wasn't railroad spikes, but it's, like, little tiny.
Yeah.
I think at one point they did show us railroad spikes to be like, this is what it was like. Through the wrist. God. Okay. So anyway, this kid has the gold egg and opens it, and it's empty. And the kid is, of course, crestfallen. And Cheryl was like, that's the greatest gift of all. The tomb was empty on Easter morning. And because the mummy walks. She was not a Goosebumps fan. She was one of the ones who would cross out the Goosebumps and Benicula books in our Scholastic Book Order and tell us we couldn't order them. So anyway, I guess all of this to say there is a overlap area between Middle Eastern politics and horror in the 90s, and it is these kind of like Jesus-inflected stories. Another good example would be the Left Behind series.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So especially that like strip of like fundamentalist Christian, like yes. That's really the overlap in the Venn diagram.
And that's when they let themselves get into horror, is it's like, well, it's horror, but it's, you know, based on the Book of Revelation, so we can like really get into it. Anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, that was mine. What else you got?
Double-crossed or working for someone else. Ah. And the first thing I thought of was Get Out, right? Where the girlfriend, you know, it turns out to be helping her mm-hmm. racist parents the whole time. And yeah. was in on it the whole time. Happens in 1984. It's also a big James Bond, like, spy trope. Mm-hmm. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where she goes to the gas station being like, oh, help me, these horrible people. And then she finds out what was really in the barbecue.
Yeah, that, I had a category double-crossing dame. Mm-hmm. So same idea. And in addition to the things you mentioned, and this has happened in another Goosebumps book, well, more than one, but the one would be Attack of the Mutant, where we had another redhead, another mm-hmm. girl he gets into, the protagonist does, and it turns out you can't trust a girl.
Yeah. Hounds of Love, too, I guess, which is based on the Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka story. So
oh, yeah.
The woman is helping trick this girl into essentially becoming a captive of this predator.
Well, and then there's all sorts of film noir movies oh, yeah. that deal with this trope. So the one I thought of with my title, Double Crossing Dame, is the 1946 film The Killers. It's based on Hemingway's story, and there's a line in it about, there's one thing I can't stand, it's a double crossing dame. So this has that. I don't know. It's a trope I like as long as there's not the part where then there's misogynistic violence unleashed on this person.
Yeah.
But when it's just like, oh, she outsmarted you, it's kind of hot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good
yeah.
for her.
Yeah. Good for yeah. her. I guess Bound would be an example of that, too.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah. It works out for the best there.
Yeah. Good for Corky. Good for Violet.
My next one was non-Westerners are superstitious. Mm-hmm. So that's really what Megan is laying on really thick. Like, I'm sure that's why they sent her in as the ally. Like, ah, another white child. He'll trust her.
And that's what I like about this one, though, is it doesn't just deal with, look at these superstitious non-American, non-Western people. They play with that stereotype. I think your reading's right when they're doing the quote-unquote purification ritual. I think they're just, like, fooling him because they know he has that stereotype.
Which is also, like, interesting because theoretically he's their royalty, right? Yeah. But I guess they're just moving past monarchy, you know?
Maybe, you know, they don't really view him as their royalty because even if he is blood related to the monarchy, he hasn't grown up there. He doesn't know anything about it. He has no allegiance to it. Like,
yeah, well, and relatedly, I feel like all of the Mummy movies, you know, even starting with the first sort of universal one that we talked about way back in our Curse of the Mummy's Tomb episode, they all traffic in this too. Like, oh, the locals are superstitious, but that's because they know. It's like they yeah. have this authentic connection to the land that the non-Westerners don't have. And that's what gets them into trouble.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones, similar, mm-hmm. especially like Temple of Doom and the sort of fucked up ones like that.
I feel like the non-Westerners are superstitious trope also comes up in horror pretty regularly.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this is one that you see in horror all the time.
Uh-huh. And then it's always the twist. It's like, oh, but now you, the Westerner, are also horrified. It was all real.
There's so many places you can point to this, right? Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and anything where people are going to another country, usually.
Yeah, well, and what I like about this book is, again, similar to Scream School, which I didn't love it in Scream School, where it's like, well, there's nothing actually supernatural happening here. In this book, there's nothing actually supernatural happening here, but the tropes are being trotted out to fool someone in a way that I find satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
My last one was chaotic nation state. My big example here would be Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a similar story of like a kingdom whose borders are being challenged all the time, changing hands a bunch, unclear who's on what side, partly because nobody's sticking to one side and the powers are as shifting as the sands of Jezekiah. And I would say that's the case in this book, too.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer heads rolling, though, than in Game of Thrones.
Yes, as far as we know.
But about as many children being given more power than really seems reasonable.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I could see Megan as a real Arya Stark type.
Not a Cersei type?
Oh, yeah. Even better. Man, I wish that series had ended better.
Everyone does.
Well, do you have any more?
Yeah. My last one was Ancient Source of Power.
Mm-hmm.
The Exorcist with the Pazuzu amulet. Again, all of the Mummy movies and all of the Indiana Jones movies Hellraiser has the Lament configuration. Mm-hmm. There's the Necronomicon. So it's like, it's old and it's full of power and we must have it to, because there's nothing in the modern world that could give us power.
Yeah, well, that's what's always interesting about them is there's this idea that when all these things boil down to some object, it makes me think, like, what is this? What are these stories really about? Where it's like, you got to get in control of the, you know, whatever the filler is, right?
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of how, so a couple months ago, we watched National Treasure. Yeah. Which, like,
A couple years ago.
I don't even remember. Time has no meaning.
Yeah.
I just remember being struck by the fact, like, oh no, we have to steal the Declaration of Independence so it doesn't fall into the wrong hands. It's like, the power doesn't reside in that document. Like, they still declared independence even if the physical piece of paper isn't there.
Well, and I guess that's one way of looking at it, right, is through the eyes of Walter Benjamin's The Work of Art in the Age of Its Mechanical Reproducibility. So we have this desire to have objects that have an aura imbued to them that makes them significant and powerful in themselves, rather than living in this world we live in where everything seems like a copy of a copy of a copy. Under the postmodern condition.
Well, that actually sort of brings it back around to your chaotic nation state category. Like, I wonder if one of the reasons why Americans love portraying other countries as chaotic messes is like, they don't have these founding documents, right? Because they're just gone for some reason that's totally unrelated to colonialism or anything that we've done.
Well, that's actually, yeah, that makes me think, because one of the things that in, you know, postmodern critical theorists like to talk about, for example, in the book Simulacra and Simulation, which we know most from The Matrix, one of the examples that gets trotted out is, like, the nation state is a simulation, right? It's no different than a drawing of it on a map. It's not real. It doesn't exist, except to the extent that we point to it and say that it does. Having stories like this that are about political drama, but have some kind of magic document at their core, like the Declaration of Independence, it's a way of trying to assert a reality to the nation's existence, right? And a validity to it.
Well, now I wish I'd looked this up, but it's not unrelated to actual nations trying to repatriate things that mm-hmm. were taken by colonizers, such as, you know, Incan remains taken by Hiram Bingham.
Because here's, like, our history, right?
Tutankhamun, yeah. Taken by Howard Carter and all of these artifacts out of Egypt. There's actually, I think, an article in the New Yorker this week about the sort of forgotten movements in Africa to, like, repatriate things because Westerners are like, no, you can't take care of it because you're right. A mess.
Because there's this doctrine of translatio imperii, which I think I brought up before, where there's this idea that, like, you know, the Greek Empire was inherited by the Romans, and then the Roman Empire was inherited by Britain, and then the U.S. inherited that. And it's this way that each subsequent empire can say, we have this longer history of validity because we are the inheritors of Greece, we are the inheritors of Rome. So when British, you know, Egyptologists take mummies and put them in the British Museum, it's a way of saying, like, this is our history.
We can house it because for some reason your infrastructure isn't very good, totally unrelated to our activities in your country.
Yeah, and we're just going to erase these, like, symbols of your historic power from your country and put them in ours.
Because I'm trying to remember now what year it was that Greece had the Olympics and they were trying to get Britain to give them the Elgin Marbles, to loan them their own their own shit for the Olympics. And they're like, we built this whole place for it. Because again, Britain would always argue, like, oh, but you can't preserve it. They're like, we built this whole thing, like, just loan it to us. And the British Museum was like, no. And I think something similar happened with a lot of Egyptian artifacts, where in Egypt, they built these, like, really nice museums because that's always the argument against it. And Britain was like, no.
Yeah. Well, and that makes me think it actually is, when we talk about the purification ritual to go in and see the mummy, it is like the Holy of Holies, because the Ark of the Covenant, which contains, like, fragments of the Ten Commandments and things like that, that's what's in the Holy of Holies. And it is a perfect example of this thing where you have an object that's imbued with an aura of power to justify the existence of your country as not just you saying you own this place.
In this story, you know, not unlike the Ark of the Covenant, what they're arguing, what the country is saying is, like, this is really valuable and we need it for that. And so, but then, of course, like, the value of it gets fought over. There was this really interesting case that where Peru tried to reclaim some Incan artifacts on the fact that they weren't monetarily valuable and only culturally valuable.
Oh, wow.
There are quipus, which are like these knotted braids that for many, many years, no one knew what they meant. They just knew they were some sort of potentially accounting or communication system. Mm-hmm. And I think somebody, like, recently deciphered, like a graduate student who was like, I'm gonna work on this. But anyway, they tried to get them back on those grounds.
Wow.
Yeah. We fell into a rabbit hole that's something I used to study a lot, which is museum politics and things like that.
I'm just imagining a future nation housing all of the Goosebumps books and not allowing the U.S. to have them back. And no, being...
you can't. You've proven that you cannot take care of them.
I'm like, but this was our most popular author. This is our greatest literary creator.
I'm sorry, but like... And no, like, you can't. I'm just trying to think of, like, what nation would be, like, any number of nations being like, I'm sorry, but you've proven unworthy of this great trove of literature.
And they're so delicate because you printed them on such shitty paper.
Yeah, like, clearly you can't have them.
Do we want to talk about shared universes? Let's
do it.
We're getting a little bit speculative. One thing I had for shared universe was just, like I said, this is a rare glimpse into international politics. And one thing I want to think about is, as we look ahead, what things that are happening in subsequent books are Pookra taking his revenge now that he's walking? If he is indeed walking, what are the effects of him having been unleashed on the world?
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because if he walked in this case, it's because presumably Megan was there, right? So she's theoretically the evil. Like, again, they were allegedly worried about the mummy walking in the first place. So I don't know who counts as evil and who doesn't in his... I don't even know, like, if he's, like, thousands of years old, I have no idea what his frame of reference is. Maybe he's like, you're all heathens and non-believers.
Yeah, you,
like,
all horrify me.
Yeah.
Or don't interest me at all.
Yeah. Bones to pick with other people.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I honestly really what the implications are, if any.
Yeah.
Because the other mummies that have come to life in this series have also not had super far-reaching implications the way that Monster Blood does.
Yeah, I feel like there's a real, again, like, Cthulhu element. You brought up Lovecraft earlier. But to what happens when you wake up a mummy. They're like, my concerns are not your concerns. They're very ancient. I have scores to settle.
Yeah.
You need, you know... Prince Koru needs to paint my chicken coop, goddammit, is, I think, more what Pookra would be upset about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have an ancient beef with ancient Egypt.
So if we were drawing out a, you know, I hope one day we will write a complete and incorrect history of the Goosebumps universe, and I would like to have a subcategory on mummies and their conflicts with each other. Uh-huh. And then I would be interested in thinking about... what up to this point or subsequent to this point is relevant to the kingdom of Jezekiah. Mm-hmm. For example, we know that last summer Michael went to the Bahamas and he was snorkeling there. And I would guess his parents might have taken him there for some reason, needing to get him out of the country, you know, related to this ongoing war.
Or they're like, we're getting the stipend for this kid. Let's live it up and go on vacation. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, where they were snorkeling, anywhere near where deep trouble was happening.
Yeah. So he really does have a passport then.
He has a passport, but I don't think he brought it to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, probably not.
To Orlando via Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, no, but you're right. It's, could there be giant fish infested waters?
Yeah, so I'd like to know what you all think. If you got theories about if Jezekiah figures into any of the other conflicts in the Gooseverse, that's my main area of shared universe interest in this book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a question that was also related to the idea of international relations. So this is one of our rare excursions outside of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lot of these stories have involved either royalty or a myth in some way.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Because we had Terror Tower, which is about these, you know, prince and princess. We had the mummy books, obviously. We had Legend of the Lost Legend.
Well, I think that growing up an American kid, that is what you think of every other country as being about.
That's
You're
true.
Like, what makes our country interesting or different is that we don't have monarchy
or culture.
Freedom, and we don't have culture. We don't have myths. We're like 10 years old,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so...
Because we don't think about the people who were here
right.
first. Yeah.
Obviously, neither of these things are true, but I would say that that's where the allure of going to another country comes up in children's books, is it gets you something that you can't get in your own country, at least as it's presented to children. It's presented as it's like, this is a democracy where everyone has a chance and there's no myths.
Yeah, not even that one.
Right? So you gotta, you know, set a story in England or something if you want those things, or Genovia, as we brought up.
Yeah. All right.
What, did you have thoughts on that question?
No, I didn't. That sort of instinct feels right to me, where it's like, oh, here are things you can't get in America.
Yeah.
Royalty and mythology.
Okay, other theories and queries.
So I had a couple questions that I've essentially raised already. I had one other question that I don't know if... Because my question was, did the mummy actually walk, which mm-hmm. we've talked about. Why did the Clarks take on this role? Were those actually rebels? I think the one that we didn't touch on is, like, what's going to happen to Michael now? And, like, what are we supposed to think about the situation? And then I had some information about mummies.
Oh, cool. Okay. So what order should we do things in?
I don't know. Well, I'll start with one because it's close to the story.
Yeah.
So theories, queries... What is going to happen to Michael now? What are we supposed to... And what are we supposed to think about this whole political situation?
I mean, it could go one of two ways. It's very open-ended as a story. And I would think one thing that could happen to Michael is he goes back to a completely ordinary, mundane life.
As R.L. Stine always makes happen, yeah.
That doesn't seem to make sense to me unless the Clarks are really trying to pull out of the conflict altogether and they're about to do a witness protection program type of move.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're going to double-cross Ramir and, like, you know, tell on him to the U.S. government or something to protect themselves. I think it seems likely that a lot of people would be motivated to off Michael because he knows too much and also isn't useful.
Yeah.
So that seems like the non-R.L. Stine ending, but a more likely one to me. And then the other one would be Michael's now an adventurer and he's going to go, you know, get involved in this conflict.
I feel like it's not that one.
No,
not, but... Not of his own volition.
That would make the best... If they were going to make a miniseries following this, that's the direction it would go in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. What about you? What do you think is going to happen to Michael?
Well, I have literally no idea what's happening with the political situation because I feel like we didn't actually get an accurate picture of it. The R.L. Stine ending is, oh, and now they go back to being a family, but I don't know how you could possibly live with these people knowing that they lied to you for your entire life. I would be, if I were Michael, I'd be totally worried that people would be coming for me again.
Right. Yeah. I bet he, did you ever see, what's that movie called? Munich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in Munich, when the guy gets back home and is trying to live a normal life, he's constantly freaked out and, like, checking every room in his house for places bombs might be mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Like, that might be Michael's next few years till he goes into therapy.
Yeah.
Or until he finds an actual bomb, right?
Yeah.
Well, I have a little bit to say about Jezekiah.
Mm-hmm.
So Jezekiah may or may not be a real name. I did Google it, and it seems like there are people named that. Mm-hmm. But the more obvious reference there for me was King Hezekiah, who was one of the kings of Israel. And I looked up a little information about it. All I remembered is that his name existed. But he reigned at a time when the Assyrian emperor was kind of moving in and taking control of Israel and Palestine, that area.
So do you think that R.L. Stine writing Jezekiah is like one step removed from writing Shmezekiah?
It is a lot like that. Like, you were asking me something similar, and I'm like, yeah, it's, I think Jezekiah is Hezekiah the way that, like, you could name a place like Shmashington, D.C., you know. Again, I think maybe R.L. Stine is vaguely remembering stuff from Hebrew school and just throwing it in there without really thinking about it. But it's not irrelevant because under Hezekiah's reign, he might have been part of a rebellion against Assyria when Sennacherib acceded to the Assyrian throne. There was rebellions all over the place, and he may have been the leader of one such rebellion. The big thing he's known for is when Jerusalem was under siege, he dug a tunnel to make sure that water could still get into the city.
Yeah.
So that's, well, I don't think he was out there digging.
No, I don't think he was either.
But that's the one thing that I had to learn about him in fundamentalist school. And that's also where I learned, like, oh, sieges of cities. You try to starve people and deny them water. And that's how you do it.
You want to say deny them water again?
And deny them water. And that's how they go.
Ah.
It's very scary. That's where I learned about that form of war crime.
Yikes.
But anyway, so it's his story is a story about someone unsuccessfully, because he wasn't able to stand up to Sennacherib, but try to defend his homeland against an invading force.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that plays into this idea of Michael basically going on a birthright tour in this story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had a little bit, because it's kind of relevant to that, a little bit to say about what was going on with Israel and Palestine in the 90s. Between 93 and 2000, that era is known as the Oslo years, because there was more prosperity in Palestine because of the Oslo Accords, and specifically in the administrative center of Palestine, which is Ramallah, mm-hmm. which is why I was thinking that maybe Ramen is Ramallah.
Yeah.
So they had, that area had been given, civil and security control had been handed over to the Palestinian Authority Administration in 95. So a lot of expatriates who had been pushed out of the area returned, started businesses, there was feelings of optimism. And then that was before, like, things started to decline and there was a big kind of uprising in 2000.
The second intifada? I don't remember very much, so... But yeah, but so this is 1999, so that means...
Right before the failure of the Camp David summit in 2000.
So yeah, so everything's on the precipice of falling apart, basically.
Yeah.
And probably people are looking at it being like, oh, is this going to go back to what it was?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's like this like shaky, like things might be getting better era of the mid-90s is seeming to about to be about to draw to a close.
I mean, that's so much of the late 90s, right? Like, oh, we thought everything was going great. Shit.
Yeah, it's so consistent with the trajectory of the Goose Verse, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I feel like you had some stuff to say about mummies.
Yeah, to pivot a little bit.
Let's look a different direction.
Well, so Emperor Pukra, he is not an Egyptian mummy. I was looking up different kinds of mummies and also the oldest mummies because he's touted as the oldest one in the world.
Yeah.
The oldest known mummy in the world. So I was wondering, you know, are there specific models for him? And so I was learning a little bit more about mummies beyond Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Longtime listeners will know I find mummies really interesting. So mummies are divided into one of two categories. So there's anthropogenic, where they were made on purpose, and then spontaneous mummies where, oops, I fell into something.
I've seen one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Seattle, in Ye Olde Curiosity Shop, Sylvester the mummy is just a guy who got shot in the stomach in the desert.
And wow.
Yeah, really messed up that that guy's just on display.
Yeah. Which you could say about a lot of mummies. So I was only interested in the anthropogenic ones because that's clearly what Pukra is supposed to be. So Egyptian mummies date back as early as 5,700 years ago. And there seems to, like, I found some disagreeing information about what the oldest mummies are. I think it's just that there's like new information, new archaeology. So the Chinchorro mummies of coastal Chile were the oldest known mummies.
Cool.
From 7,000 years ago. Basically, it was understood that they are the oldest intentionally prepared mummified bodies ever found, beginning in the 5th millennium BC and continuing for an estimated 3,500 years. All human burials in the Chinchorro culture were prepared for mummification. The bodies were carefully prepared, beginning with removal of the internal organs and skin before being
Gotta get those organs out.
Yeah, left
put them in a jar.
Exactly. Left in the Atacama Desert, which aided in desiccation.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and a lot of them were, which is also part of the Egyptian mummy process. A large number of these mummies were also prepared by skilled artisans to be preserved in more artistic fashion, although the purpose of this practice is widely debated. So more recently, there were bodies found in Portugal's Sado Valley, which might be some of the oldest, around 8,000 years. Mm. And basically, there was an article in the Journal of Archaeology arguing that the way they were positioned would suggest intentionality versus being just a spontaneous mummy. Exactly. Yeah. And then there's also the Spirit Cave mummy, which is the oldest human mummy found in North America, which is 9,400 years old.
So
which would make it the oldest.
And it'd be consistent with like academia to write off, you know, indigenous North American history as relevant.
Right. Yeah. It was discovered near Fallon, Nevada. And basically, he was discovered during salvage work prior to guano mining activity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so he is a middle-aged man. He was found completely dressed and lying on a blanket made of animal skin. They did radiocarbon dating. And so this is, I think, also one of the earliest instances of using radiocarbon dating to date a mummy. He was put into the Nevada State Museum, and then the local Native American community started petitioning to have him returned and repatriated in 1995. So pretty close to this. The Bureau of Land Management was like, nah. And so in 2000, the Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe sued under the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act. And they DNA tested the mummy and found that he was, in fact, related to modern Native Americans. And so he was repatriated to the tribe
Oh, wow.
In 2016. Yeah.
Doesn't usually happen that way.
No. Yeah. And then also there was a mummified infant found in Libya in the 50s who is dated between 5,000 and 8,000 years old.
Why do you think people mummify? Is it because you want to like go and look at the person again? Or is it because you're just like, I've seen rotting bodies and I don't want that to happen to you?
I mean, it's the same reason we embalm them, right? Like,
I would I don't.
Well, I know you don't specifically, but...
And I've never understood it, really, because I'm like, well, you're just not going to see them again. You're putting them in the ground.
Well, I mean, part of it, I think, has to do with religious culture, right? Like, in the Egyptian model, I know it's...
oh, yeah, that's true.
Preparation for the afterlife, and you have to preserve your body in order to get to the afterlife. I imagine some of it is out of respect, like, you know, placing them with a blanket. One of the interesting things about mummies is that's how people have also learned about early humans mm-hmm. and early human culture. Like, some of the oldest evidence we have of, like, human society are finding that bodies were buried with flowers or with pigments yeah. because it shows, like, oh, there's this, you know, there's some ritual around death because they didn't just fall and die. It was, you know, something was very intentional there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it is probably a combination of respect and tradition and belief.
And it's interesting then when it gets into a, you know, pulpy story like this about mummies where that all gets completely wiped away and everything about the preservation that was supposed to be about honoring a specific person becomes, this is just a cool object for me to mess with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. People fight over it. It's maybe evil.
Yeah, it seems like it's a bad luck to get preserved beyond the lifespan of the people who cared about you.
Yeah.
My final point is about the name Pukra. Apparently there is something called a Pukra stone.
Oh.
And it's a sapphire, actually.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, so, because I googled Pukra just to see what came up, and what came up is the yellow sapphire, which in Hindu scriptures is considered to be one of the most auspicious and beneficial stones. The Pukraj, it's like Pukraj is sometimes how it's written, stone, or Pushraja, or Pitmani, there's a bunch of different names for it. It has a special place in the world of astrology. It's believed to hold the powers of the planet Jupiter. It is a symbol of courage and intelligence, and it's supposed to bring prosperity to a person's life.
Oh.
So I wondered if that was the sapphire. Maybe Arlstein randomly came across this fact, or maybe it's a total coincidence.
Yeah.
But the sapphire bringing prosperity has some basis in the real world, too.
No, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how many things in this book are tangential to things in the real world, you know, be they current events, objects, or just, you know, myths. And they're all sort of blended together in this weird way that it's like, I don't know what these things all mean together.
Well, you know what it most reminds me of is the Nutcracker Ballet a little bit, where it's just like, this is a kid who had too much candy, fell asleep, and is having like a weird fucking dream about like the rats in her kitchen and her creepy grandfather and like the clock. And it's all gotten very strange. I think this is like, Arlstein had too much candy and had been watching the news and he like fell asleep and this is what tumbled out.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
scale of 1 to 5 bewares?
2.5.
Really?
So I loved talking about it with you, aww, but reading it.
I love you talking about stuff with me.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, I'd even bump it up to a 3 for that, but like reading it, I was like, what the fuck is this? This doesn't make any sense.
I'm honored that talking with me is a 3-star experience.
You're welcome, baby. That's how much it elevated the book for me.
Thank you.
I think also it's a personal preference thing, right? I think back when we read The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, you realized you kind of like adventure stories and things like that. And it tends to be less my jam.
Yeah, you're totally right. Because I was going to give this a 4 to 4.5. Yeah. I just really enjoyed it. And I was like, whoa, what a weird story. Like, great opening. I want to understand what's going on here politically. Had fun with it. Pythons.
Yeah. And for me, it's like, I don't know, tell me about your feelings about being abandoned and / being lied to. And also, if you're going to bring up the economy, double down and explain to me how this fucking works. Otherwise, I'm just wondering about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Goosepunks, we want to know what you think about the mummy walks.
Yeah. Did the mummy actually walk? Did anything supernatural happen? Because I'm not convinced.
Yeah, is this yet another Goosebumps book where nothing supernatural happens? How many bewares would you give it? You can write to us at saypodanddie@gmail.com.
You can also get in touch on Twitter and Instagram at saypodanddie.
And you can join us next week for a story that I'm told has as many, if not more, daddy issues than Scream School.
That's a tall order.
It is. It's called The Werewolf in the Living Room.
And be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Leave us 5 bewares on whatever platform you got this podcast. It helps us reach more followers and it makes us feel happy.
Listener beware.
Those were the scares.
Good boo.
Good boo.
I watched the mummy's frail crossed arms unfold. The mummy walks, General Ramir cried. The mummy stuck out its arms stiffly and staggered forward. It scraped its gauzed feet over the cave floor, sending up clouds of dust. The lights darted over the mummy as it leaned forward, staggering stiffly, arms outstretched. And then the circles of light swung away and swept over the cave as General Ramirez's men turned away. a rush of light toward the cave entrance. Moaning in terror, whispering their shock, the men followed the light. They stampeded over the rock-strewn floor, kicking up thick curtains of dust. It reminded me of an old black-and-white movie, all out of focus, running at the wrong speed. The strange scene had frozen me in place. The cold horror had paralyzed me. I turned to run. Too late. The mummy was on me. The mummy grabbed me by the throat with its ancient, dusty hands. So strong, so inhumanly strong. It wrapped its hands around my throat and started to squeeze.